Hi everyone, and welcome to Ask the Horse Live. I'm your host, Haley Peffer, Digital Managing Editor at thehorse.com. Managing a horse diagnosed with metabolic problems means understanding how conditions such as equine metabolic syndrome and insulin dysregulation increase the risk of serious complications, including laminitis. Horses with metabolic problems often benefit from controlled diets low in sugars and starches, tailored to prevent spikes in blood insulin and support healthy body condition. Regular exercise and weight management should be part of a comprehensive plan because activity can help improve insulin sensitivity and supports overall metabolic health. While there's no cure for these conditions, strategic research-based care can help improve your metabolic horse's well-being. This event is sponsored by DECRA. To answer your questions tonight, we are joined by expert panelists Dr. Katrin Lowndes of the University of Pennsylvania and Dr. Greg Schmid with DECRA. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Lowndes, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Absolutely. So I attended the University College Dublin School of Veterinary Medicine in Ireland and graduated in 2020. I had grown up riding horses and knew pretty early on equine practice was where I wanted to be. I spent most of the first 4 years of my career in first opinion field practice, first with Root and Riddle in Saratoga Springs, and then with UPenn's New Bolton Center, where I completed a field service residency program and became a boarded diplomat of the American Board of Veterinary Practitioners, specialized in equine practice. A little over a year and a half ago, I transitioned into a research position with the Van Epps Laminitis and Endocrinology Lab here at New Bolton to further explore an interest in endocrinology and laminitis. Most of my research at the moment is focused on improvement of early diagnosis and management of equine metabolic syndrome with a focus on translational research. In other words, research that can be directly implemented into clinical practice. I look forward to answering some questions with you guys tonight.
Thank you. And Dr. Schmid, can you tell us a little bit about your background and your role with DECRA?
Sure. So I grew up in Ohio, where I was lucky enough to grow up with horses in my backyard. And I was a member of Pony Club for as long as I can remember. As I got to be older, my equestrian sport of choice was eventing. And I also competed on the intercollegiate dressage team in college. I graduated from the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. From there, I went on to do a private practice internship at BW Furlong and Associates in New Jersey. And then I practiced up and down the East Coast with a sports medicine-based practice for a few years. And then I moved across the country to Portland, Oregon, and was an associate at a practice called Columbia Equine Hospital for about 4 or 5 years there. And now I've been with DECRA for 5 years, and I currently serve as the medical affairs lead for our equine team. So my role focuses on supporting the technical marketing and of our entire equine portfolio and leading our educational initiatives. And on a personal note, one of my family's horses, Roy, he's been with us since 1998 when he was born. He has both PPID and EMS. So I'm very excited to be here tonight and look forward to the discussion.
Oh, thank you. Before we begin answering questions, I want to remind everyone of our Ask the Horse Live format. We're starting with questions that were submitted during registration. If you're listening live and would like to submit a question, please do so via the chat window. We'll do our best to get to as many of your questions as possible. If you're listening to the podcast recording of this event and would like to join us live in the future, please visit thehorse.com/askthehorselive to register for notifications. And with that, we're going to jump in. So our first question of the night is for you, Dr. Lowndes. It's from Ryan in Florida, who wants to know what the differences are between EMS, PPID, and IID.
Hi, Ryan. Thanks for a great question to get us started. So starting with insulin dysregulation, this is basically just an umbrella term referring to abnormalities in insulin dynamics, whether that be problems with insulin production in the pancreas, insulin clearance in the liver, generalized insulin resistance, or other insulin issues. With this, it typically boils down to, in the horse, is hyperinsulinemia or elevated insulin concentrations in the bloodstream, which is what is responsible for causing endocrinopathic laminitis in these horses. Equine metabolic syndrome is a collection of risk factors for the development of endocrinopathic laminitis. The most important of these is going to be insulin dysregulation, and the two terms have almost become interchangeable in everyday use. However, another hallmark of EMS is abnormal fat accumulation, either regional, so that's your cresty neck, your fat pads on either side of the tail, or around the shoulder, over the ribs, and behind the saddle area, or it can be generalized fat accumulation, so just overall obesity. Other features of equine metabolic syndrome include abnormalities in adipokines or fat hormones, particularly leptin, adiponectin, high triglycerides, altered reproductive cycles, and increased inflammatory markers. An important distinction between equine metabolic syndrome and PPID is that equine metabolic syndrome doesn't have an age predilection, so it can occur in both young and older horses. For PPID, that's pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction, also known as equine Cushing's colloquially, and that's caused by a benign functional tumor or overgrowth on the pituitary gland. This results in a production of excessive amounts of ACTH and is associated with clinical signs like abnormal hair coat or shedding, muscle wastage, weight loss, and general kind of ill thriftiness, abnormal sweating, which can either be anhidrosis or lack of sweating, or hyperhidrosis, over sweating, increased water intake and urination, decreased immune response leading to increased rates of and severity of infections such as dermatitis, non-healing corneal ulcers, abscesses, respiratory infections, and such. And we also see slower healing in these animals. PPID is typically a disease of older horses in their teens to 20s. Where people tend to get confused between the three is that it's quite common to have both PPID and metabolic syndrome concurrently in older horses. The jury is out on whether or not PPID truly induces insulin dysregulation of its own accord, or if it just exacerbates it in animals already inclined towards metabolic issues. But it is generally accepted that the presence of PPID is associated with increased likelihood of having insulin dysregulation. That said, they are separate diseases, and not every horse with PPID has insulin dysregulation, and vice versa. So it's important to establish the status of both diseases in animals when making management and treatment plans.
Dr. Schmid, Hannah in California asks how horse owners can tell if their horse might have metabolic problems, and are any horses in particular at a higher risk than others?
Yeah, hi Hannah, and thanks for the great question. Basically, to simplify it, and as Dr. Lowndes said, there is a distinction between insulin dysregulation and PPID. So I will start with the insulin dysregulation equine metabolic syndrome kind of category, where I think the best thing to look for is obesity, or specifically regional adiposity, or having these fat pads. So the things like the cresty neck and the fat pads on each side of the tailhead are a really good clue. Also, any history of laminitis or hoof ring changes can also be a really good clue that your horse may be dealing with a metabolic problem. And sometimes they're just an easy keeper who is resistant to weight loss despite diet and exercise strategies. So that can also be a clue to look for insulin dysregulation. For PPID, the most common early indication and the most easily recognized indication is a regional or patchy long curly hair coat and or delayed shedding. So you're definitely going to want to monitor their essentially just their hair coat and their shedding. That might look like retained guard hairs or those long wispy hairs, usually on the underside of their neck or belly. That can be a hint of that as well. And then PPID, another common sign is just a loss of muscle. So you might notice that the top line muscle is just atrophying or and lost in general there, or a change in attitude, things like lethargy. And abnormal sweating can also be a sign or a clue of PPID. And then regarding horses at higher risk, again, just strictly speaking about insulin dysregulation, there's sort of a long list of breeds that tend to be at a higher risk. So ponies, miniature horses, Iberian breeds like Andalusians and Lusitanos, I feel like they all have a cresty neck. Gated breeds like saddlebreds, Pasifinos, Morgans, Arabians, Warmbloods, And I also like to throw in just any easy keeper breed. This may be a horse that you don't know essentially what breed it is, but it is certainly an easy keeper. It may have a genetic predisposition to EMS or insulin dysregulation. Any horse can develop it too with improper management or a diet. Predisposed breeds are certainly more susceptible, but any horse could develop insulin dysregulation with improper diet. For PPID, it's really just comes down to age. It's more prevalent in horses that are older. It's reported as to affect 20% of horses 15 years of age and older, and up to 30% of horses older than 30. So really the risk factor there is really just older age.
Dr. Lowndes, Carrie in Australia wants to know what the process is for testing hay and how to know if the hay is safe for metabolic horses.
Okay. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for the question. So for some people out there, your hay provider may be actually able to provide you with a hay analysis if they do it routinely anyway. But if they don't do them routinely, or you grow your own hay, a good resource for getting your hay tested is often going to be reaching out to your local agricultural extension or agricultural school. Once you find somewhere to send your hay, they will likely walk you through exactly what kind of sample they want you to send. In an ideal world, you would test every single bale, but that's not usually practical in the real world setting. So you will take a representative sample of each batch instead. This usually means taking samples from 10 to 20% of the bales in a batch using a hay core. It's important to repeat the hay analysis for each batch because the analysis can change with season, year, or even area of the field the hay was harvested from, if there's a difference in sun exposure, soil composition, or moisture. Ideally, with metabolic horses, we're aiming for hays with NSCs or non-structural carbohydrates less than 10%. NSC trends lower in more mature hay and warm season grasses or legume hay, but this isn't a hard and fast rule. And the only real way to ensure a hay is low NSC is to have it tested. In terms of safety for your horse, you can also evaluate your horse's individual response to hay by having your veterinarian do a meal challenge if they have the availability in their schedule to do that for you. This would typically require fasting the horse for about 4 hours, then pulling a baseline insulin, feed the hay, and repeat an insulin in about 90 minutes post introducing the hay. And this will tell you if the hay is inducing an insulin spike in your specific horse. NSC and hay can be further lowered by soaking, preferably in warm water, for about 16 minutes prior to feeding. We don't typically recommend prolonged soaking more than 3 hours, and definitely not overnight, as this can lead to increased likelihood of mold growing.
Dr. Schmidt, Sheila in Kentucky asked if supplements can help a horse with ID. If so, how can she tell if a supplement is high quality?
This is such a great question, and I have certainly tried a few supplements for Roy over the years as myself. There are actually some supplements that have shown modest improvement in glucose insulin dynamics in horses. There's a couple of them contain resveratrol or blends of antioxidants and polyphenols or plant-based metabolic compounds typically found in red grape skins or berries. So there's some evidence that resveratrol or supplements that contain resveratrol could be helpful. There's also been some recent work looking at the mineral chromium. It has been shown to enhance the action of insulin, and one study, at least in horses supplemented with chromium, did show that they were able to kind of mitigate the increase in glucose. So it's a possibility, but still there's a lot we don't know about chromium, and we don't even have a recommended daily requirement for chromium. So it's still a kind of an unknown there. And then most recently, actually, there was an ingredient with a name that I will not try to pronounce, but it's abbreviated as 1-DNJ. It's a naturally occurring alkaloid commonly found in mulberry leaves. So you'll probably hear about supplements that advertise using mulberry leaves. This one particular supplement, the compound will help to limit carbohydrate breakdown and therefore limit the ability to absorb the sugars from carbohydrates. So it's kind of a unique mechanism of action there where it can potentially block sugar absorption. And this one study found that if it's given an hour before feeding twice a day, there was some attenuation of the insulin response after a meal. So potential for that to be helpful as well. When it comes to assessing quality, I usually look for either a vet recommendation or evidence of research in horses, in metabolic horses specifically. And that research is limited so far. So there's not that many of them that have kind of checked that box for me, but there's at least an interest in this and there's definitely ongoing work in this. So there could be more ingredients and more supplements in the future, but Dr. Lowndes, do you know of one that I've missed?
No, you've hit all the ones I would have mentioned.
Yeah, they're just, at this point, still kind of a limitation there of just not a lot of work has been done on that topic.
Awesome, thank you. Dr. Lowndes, Becky in Illinois asked what a veterinarian might consider an SGLT2 inhibitor for a very overweight ID and PPID horse.
Hi, Becky. So these SGLT2 inhibitors are a pretty hot topic in the veterinary world at the moment, and we've actually been doing some research in them ourselves. I tend to base my decisions in these cases on what the insulin is doing and if there is active clinical laminitis. I usually classify horses as mildly, moderately, or severely dysregulated. I consider severely dysregulated animals to be ones with those kind of three-figure insulins, so 100 micro international units per mil or above. And these animals are the ones that are at high risk of having a laminitic episode, if not already experiencing one. And so these are the ones I would tend to reach for the SGLT2 inhibitors on because I want to get that insulin down fast and get inflammation under control in order to buy myself time to implement diet, exercise, and management changes and address exacerbating factors such as weight or uncontrolled PPID before we have a laminitic crisis on our hands. Ultimately, to me, SGLT2 inhibitors are rescue drugs. So in horses or ponies where the dysregulation is mild or even moderate, usually there's enough time, in my experience, to try implementing diet and management changes first before jumping to pharmaceuticals. I think it's important to remember with these drugs that they're there to complement the traditional approach to management, not replace it. This is particularly true, I feel, with the SGLT2 inhibitors, which control insulin and do it very well, but don't actually seem to improve overall metabolic health outside of maybe some weight loss side effects, which is why we can see insulin rapidly increase following discontinuing these drugs if exacerbating factors such as the weight, diet, management, etc., have not been addressed.
Dr. Schmid, Jennifer wants to know how to handle a mare in late gestation who also has metabolic problems.
Yeah, this is a great question too, Jennifer. And number one, I'll have to say the best thing to do is to work with your vet and to have a plan either before she reaches late gestation or hopefully before she reaches foaling. But as with any horses with metabolic problems, it's going to be best to maintain a low NSC forage-based diet, have controlled energy intake, try to minimize any hyperinsulinemia, provide appropriate exercise too, if it's safe for the pregnancy, even if it's just walking, and then definitely monitor body condition very regularly, you definitely want to avoid excessive weight gain. I also think that your vet and you can work together to come up with a plan to monitor specific metabolic parameters, and that will give you the information you need to adjust the diet safely as she goes through her pregnancy. And then if the mare is managed with any medications, this is particularly important for PPID, it is important to work with your vet to have a plan for those specific medications. So for example, pergolide treatment can affect lactation. And so you'll wanna, again, plan ahead and talk to your vet about the best approach for managing the PPID and the treatment plan in that late gestation kind of foaling timeline.
I'd also like to throw in there that some of these insulin regulating drugs are not advised to use during pregnancy. SGLT2 inhibitors have been associated with fetal abnormalities in humans, and pioglitazone has also been associated with delayed maturation of fetuses in humans.
Yeah, and those drugs not being fully investigated and FDA approved at this point, we just, you know, don't have all that information at this point. So it is, yeah, that's a great point, is to be very careful with all of those.
Dr. Lowndes, Beth in our live audience says her mare became overweight due to a number of reasons, and the blood work showed an increase in insulin and glucose. But once she lost the weight, the values were normal. Is her mare still considered to have insulin dysregulation?
Yes, I would say she's got, at this stage, what we would refer to as well-controlled insulin dysregulation. And likely in her case, her obesity was the main exacerbating or driving factor in her insulin dysregulation, but I wouldn't count her safe at this stage, because obviously she's got a little predisposition there. Not every horse that becomes obese actually develops insulin dysregulation. So I would consider her a well-controlled insulin dysregulated or metabolic horse.
So thank you. And Dr. Lowndes, Norm from Ontario asks if you can explain the risks associated with allowing metabolic horses on pasture.
Totally. Hi Norm, fantastic question. The main problem with grass pasture is that it is very hard to predict and control, one, how much is being consumed by the horse, and two, how much NSC there is in the pasture. So studies looking at consumption have, in the average, like 500 kilogram or 1100 pound horse will typically consume 1 to 1.4 pounds of grass per hour, which if you've got a horse on pasture 24/7 at the upper end would be nearly 1.7 times maintenance requirement. Hence why some horses get fat on grass pasture. Muzzling can restrict this intake, but the amount of decrease we see varies from 30 to 80% decrease depending on the study. This variation can make managing weight while out on pasture very difficult. The NSC is another problem depending on the type of grass and the season. It can be extraordinarily high NSC, reported up to 40% NSC, which is not ideal when we're trying to keep our NSC of our diet below 10%. NSC in grass is also extraordinarily variable, influenced by season, growth stage, rainfall, and even time of day, meaning that grass that was safe one week may not be safe the next for your horse.
Dr. Schmidt, Wendy in Indiana wants to know the benefits and risks associated with alfalfa hay for horses with metabolic problems. She says she often hears conflicting information from different sources.
Yeah, you and me both, Wendy. So alfalfa hay can be a very safe part of a diet for a horse with metabolic problems. The benefit is that alfalfa is often lower in sugar than some of the common cool season grass hays that we think of. So it still needs to be proven that it's low in sugar, and I still would test it and make sure that the NSC concentration is low, but that is ultimately the one benefit that we keep going back to alfalfa hay for, is that it is can be lower in sugar than the cool season grass haze. Still comes with some risks. It definitely is tends to be higher in calories and protein, which can contribute to weight gain. So if you've got, you know, that easy keeper metabolic horse, sometimes you just have to offer them such a small amount of alfalfa hay that they're still not exactly satisfied. And the high protein itself may occasionally stimulate insulin in some individuals. So you still want to monitor that insulinemia response with an alfalfa-based diet as well. So potentially, you know, beneficial, but it's still very important to test your hay and work with your veterinarian or a nutritionist on formulating a well-balanced diet.
Dr. Lowndes, Leslie in California asked what the best weight management strategies are for horses with metabolic problems.
Hi, Leslie. Very pertinent question. So when dealing with overweight horses, stringent calorie restriction really is going to be your best bet. We typically like to start with feeding forage at about 1.5 to 2% ideal body weight per day. So when I say ideal body weight, I mean that's the weight I would like the horse to be rather than what the weight it currently is. The best way to do this is to actually weigh out your hay in a hay net for each feeding, and this can be done with a handheld luggage scale. We typically give this about 4 to 6 weeks to see some movement in body weight before getting a little impatient. If weight isn't budging, you can drop as low as 1% ideal body weight in stubborn cases, but I really wouldn't recommend going below that because then you can start dealing with problems like gastric ulcers. If you're not got enough forage in the diet, soaking hay to remove water-soluble carbohydrates can also decrease the calories of the hay, so that can be another great tool in your kit if you've got one of these stubborn cases. Again, as discussed in the answer to Norm's question, restricting forage appropriately can be difficult in horses on pasture because it's hard to gauge exactly how much they are getting. So if you have access to a dry lot, that's going to be very helpful in appropriate weight management. Otherwise, there may be some trial and error to getting the balance with forage correct. Another big thing is if feeding a ration balancer, you do actually want to check that it's low NSC because not all ration balancers are created equally. You can usually do this quickly yourself by adding the sugar and starch percentages on the back of the bag if they're there. If they're not there, you can check the feed website, or Mad Barn has a lot of nutritional information on the common feeds available. Increasing exercise where possible is also helpful, not only in weight loss, but even just improving metabolic health. If diet restriction and exercise alone are not working, then you could also discuss the addition of levothyroxine sodium with your veterinarian. This is a synthetic thyroid hormone, the purpose of which is to increase metabolism to drive weight loss, but it must be used in conjunction with dietary restriction, or else it will just result in the horse eating more and not losing weight. If you've got the opposite problem, so one of these so-called skinny metabolic horses, which can often happen when you've got concurrent PPID and metabolic syndrome, then you want to focus on a high-fat, good-quality protein diet to increase calorie intake in a safer manner than these high carbohydrate diets.
Dr. Schmidt, June in Pennsylvania wants to know what health problems are common in horses with metabolic problems besides laminitis.
Okay, June. Yeah, so laminitis is definitely the number one concern, but besides laminitis, horses with insulin dysregulation can of course be in a hyperinsulinemia state or high blood insulin concentration. And at this point, it's sort of considered to be a pro-inflammatory state. So they could be at risk of sort of any condition that involves inflammation, although that's not a whole lot of specific correlations so far. With PPID, there is quite a long list of potential secondary health problems or comorbidities, including things like tendon and ligament laxity, or even tendon and ligament injuries, infertility, exercise intolerance, and altered mentation, which typically looks like lethargy. You can have some random things like chronic infections and recurrent corneal ulcers as well. So definitely PPID is the disease that oftentimes comes along with additional health problems.
Dr. Lowndes, Roseanne in Iowa has a 14-year-old pony that is laminitic. Will grass ever be safe for this mare again? And could you tell us why or why not?
Hi, Roseanne. Unfortunately, I cannot speak directly to your case as I don't know all the particulars. I think the main thing is that there will always be risks associated with grass when it comes to metabolic horses, though that risk can be very variable from horse to horse. I've had some patients where obesity and uncontrolled PPID have been the main driving factors in their insulin dysregulation. And once those things were under control, they could be managed on limited grass turnout with a muzzle. But then I've also had others that, even with everything else under control, still couldn't tolerate any grass turnout without getting sore again. So again, as discussed in the answer to Norm's question, the NSC in grass can be very variable, which means that just because a horse appears well managed on pasture doesn't mean they will continue to be as season and weather conditions change. This means the safest place for these animals really is in the dry lot if possible. Though I do realize that isn't possible for everyone. If you don't have a dry lot available, turnout should be restricted to early morning when the NSC in the grass is at the lowest. And keep in mind, in temperate climates where there's seasonal change, early spring and late fall are going to be high risk periods as the grass is storing NSC with a slow growth rate. And periods of drought are also going to be high risk for the same reason.
Dr. Schmidt, Sarah in Pennsylvania wants to know how she can balance palatability with safe feed options for a picky metabolic horse.
Hi, Sarah. This is such a great question, such a tricky question, because pickiness can be such an individual thing and certainly make it quite a challenge to feed some horses anything at all. But you will want to stick with low NSC. A diet, and then that palatability might be something where you find a nutrient balanced balancer or ration balancer that your horse prefers. There's several on the market. I would just, again, as we've noted before, make sure you're looking at the label and making sure that it is truly low NSC. But some horses just have a preference for one ration balancer over another. Something that I've done myself too is try to mix in some safe fiber. So low NSC hay pellets soaked, things like beet pulp without molasses. Sometimes horses prefer that. Also some tips like gradually reintroducing or introducing new feeds, and then just monitoring their acceptance of the feed as best as you can and making the changes as needed. But this is certainly very tricky. Some horses are just, you know, turn up their nose at anything that doesn't contain a bunch of molasses. So I don't know, Dr. Lowndes, do you have any tips or tricks for these picky eaters?
I wish. No, your answer was fantastic.
Yeah, it's just a tough thing to deal with a horse that's got a limited menu options and being picky on top of it.
For sure. Dr. Schmidt, Raven in our live audience says she's had horses that have had appetite suppression with the introduction of Pergolide. Do you have any tips for avoiding this and getting them eating again?
Yeah, that's a well-reported adverse or side effect of Pergolide is anorexia or appetite suppression. So the label will describe cutting the dose in half for like 2 to 3 weeks and then gradually reintroducing the needed dose. Some veterinarians as well will start their horses that they're treating on a lower dose than they know is necessary and then gradually build up to a dose that the targeted dose essentially. Pergolide should also be titrated to effect as well. So anytime you're making a dose adjustment, it's best to make those adjustments as small as possible and then as gradual as possible as well.
Dr. Lowndes, Terry in our live audience would like to see what you think of using TEFHEY or TEFHEY pellets to help a metabolic horse lose weight.
Yeah, totally. So TEFHEY is one of those, and TEF is one of those grasses that does trend a little lower typically on NSC. However, again, just because it trends lower doesn't mean every single batch is actually going to be low NSC. So it's still worth getting a proper hay analysis done if you're using the hay, if you're getting it as bagged TEF. Again, there's normally an analysis on the bag that you can check out and just ensure that it is low NSC. But it can be a good option for these metabolic horses.
Dr. Lowndes, Judy in Canada asks if there's any link between EMS and anemia.
Hi, Judy. So I found this question very interesting because I hadn't really thought about there being a link between EMS and anemia before. So I did go on a little dig through the literature for you. And what I found was one author that said they had observed anemia in horses with metabolic syndrome that had liver damage secondary to hepatic lipidysis. So in those cases, the anemia is more likely related to that liver damage than the metabolic syndrome itself. And I couldn't really find any other potential links between equine metabolic syndrome and anemia. Thanks for the question.
Dr. Schmidt, Don in Texas wants to know how to develop a diet for a horse with ID.
Yeah, hi, Don. This is a great question. It's a complex question, too. Short question, but pretty complex. So I think the steps that I would keep in mind is think about your forage first. And again, you'll want to feed a lab-tested low NSC hay. Limit pasture intake. So controlled turnout times, muzzle use, dry lots are great for getting horses outside without all that exposure to lush green pasture. Definitely restrict grains and sugary feeds. Completely eliminate anything that's a high starch feed. And then you still want to include balanced nutrients. So providing vitamin and mineral balancers, and making sure that they are getting a balanced diet without the excess of calories is very important. And then you always need to monitor these horses and monitor them, especially after a diet adjustment, to make sure that you're adjusting the caloric intake to achieve that target weight and body condition score that you're looking for. So it is a little bit of extra work, but it's never typically a set the diet and stay on it for the rest of their life. It's usually adjustments made throughout. So I would say best thing to do is to work with your veterinarian. Equine nutritionists are very helpful as well, and just, you know, customize that diet plan and then make a plan for reevaluations and adjustments as needed.
Dr. Lowndes, we've talked a bit about treatment and management, but Rebecca in North Carolina asks if there are any ways to prevent a horse from developing PPID or EMS.
Hi, Rebecca. $1 million question. I'll start with PPID. The simple answer right now is unfortunately no. There's a lot of research currently ongoing looking into risk factors and pathogenesis for this disease. Hopefully one day might lead to a different answer to that question, but right now the answer is no, unfortunately. For equine metabolic syndrome, keeping weight under control and keeping your horse fit and active is going to go a long way into keeping equine metabolic syndrome and insulin dysregulation at bay. Even just 15 minutes of light exercise 5 days a week has been shown to improve insulin dynamics and adiponectin concentrations over a 6-week period. This is important because adiponectin has been suggested to have a protective effect against the development of ID and laminitis in ponies in research out of the UK. It's also worth considering that a low NSC diet can be beneficial in animals without metabolic issues currently as well, and focusing on providing calories through good quality protein and fats instead of inactive horses. I think, though, it's also worth keeping in mind that even fit, active horses can develop some low degree of metabolic issues, and those can start to rear their heads if an injury occurs and the horse ends up on stall rest. So another important thing is going to be regular screening in at-risk horses to identify and address a problem before it progresses to laminitis. Ideally, this would be performed by doing oral sugar tests once or twice a year, but that's often not feasible due to the time it takes to perform that test. So an alternative is to do a single blood draw for either resting or postprandial insulin. When I say postprandial insulin, I mean the blood is drawn 2 hours after a grain meal is given, and this kind of works as a poor man's meal challenge. The problem with this, obviously, is that insulin displays a lot of biological variations, so single insulins can be unreliable, and you can't always take a normal insulin for granted when you're just doing a baseline insulin. So to get around this, we typically also run adiponectin and leptin as part of our screening process. These are both fat hormones. Adiponectin is typically considered a good fat hormone with insulin sensitizing and anti-inflammatory properties, and is much more stable than insulin under a number of different circumstances. Leptin is associated with adiposity, or body fat percentage. So low adiponectin, as I discussed, has been associated. Adiponectin is thought to be protective against ID and laminitis, and low adiponectin has been associated with both increased likelihood and risk for ID and laminitis. Leptin also has weak associations with ID by itself, but we are preparing research for publication showing that the ratio of leptin to adiponectin, which has been frequently used in human medicine, is a better marker for both presence of insulin dysregulation and laminitis than either adiponectin or leptin alone in horses as well. So this can just kind of improve the quality of our single drawn blood test a little bit when we can't do dynamic testing.
Dr. Schmidt, Terry in Utah wants to know what causes a horse's insulin levels to spike and how long it usually takes for them to return to normal. Is any spike in insulin considered normal?
Yeah, great question. So the cause of insulin spikes is really eating, usually carbohydrates, which linked especially to non-structural carbohydrates or NSCs, and some links to high protein diets as well. So mostly we're thinking about sugars and starches though, so hay and pasture and concentrate. So after a horse eats these things, a glucose surge in their blood occurs, and that triggers the insulin release. Stress and external factors can also alter insulin response as well. And then with insulin dysregulated horses, they just happen to produce a larger insulin spike in response to the same meal that a normal horse might receive. Regarding your timing, in normal horses, insulin rises after eating, and then it generally returns to baseline approximately 2 hours after a carbohydrate meal. In insulin dysregulated horses, that insulin can remain elevated for much higher level and also much longer levels. And that's going to be based on individual disease. And then the last question, is any spike in insulin considered normal? Yeah, basically any insulin response after eating is normal. It's just those excessively high peaks or excessively long peaks that we're looking for. And that's how we base our diagnoses on insulin dysregulation.
I'll just throw in there, like even the normal peaks. So when we're talking about a high peak, if you our lab, our cutoff for normal resting is 20 and post-neural sugar test is it only goes up to 30. So that's when we challenge them. We still expect them to be less than 30. If you're using Cornell's lab, I believe their resting is about 30 and their cutoff for post-neural sugar test is 45. So these still aren't massive peaks. If you're going up to 60, 70, 80, that's abnormal.
Yeah, more like a small rolling hill versus a mountain.
Dr. Lowndes, Carol from our live audience would like to know if experiencing a traumatic event can cause an upswing in a horse's cortisol, raising the insulin level and even leading to a laminitic episode.
Normally not, because to induce laminitis, it needs to kind of be, as Dr. Smith said in that last, it's not just a once-off peak, it's about the sustained peak we're seeing after induction of hyperinsulinemia. So it's not going to be, okay, we went up and we came down in a matter of hours. It's going to be, we went up and we stayed there for 24, 48 hours. And normally a stress hyperinsulinemia isn't going to stay up like that for that long.
Dr. Schmid, Holly from our live audience wants to know if insulin dysregulation affects glycogen levels in muscle tissue and how it might. She has a horse with generalized body pain, and thus far a muscle biopsy revealed depleted glycogen and blood work indicates insulin dysregulation.
That is a great question. Depleted glycogen in muscle biopsies is... And Dr. Lowndes, do you know if there's a correlation there? I haven't heard of one myself.
No, I'm not familiar with one either. I would say more likely there's two different disease processes.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to thinking. Is you probably found two issues at the same time.
Thank you. Dr. Lowndes, Linda asks if DSLD could be related to metabolic problems.
Hi, Linda. So it has been suggested that horses with PPID are more susceptible to degenerative tendon and ligament injuries, either due to reduction in tensile strength or delayed healing. And there has been one paper suggesting a link between PPID and DSLD, but unfortunately the literature is still a little bit lacking in this area.
Dr. Schmid, Melissa in our live audience says her 8-year-old Minnie was recently diagnosed with ID and PPID. She just started the mare on pergolide and a metabolic supplement, and the mare has mild laminitis. With an insulin of 200, should she consider giving an SGLT2 inhibitor?
Well, I would definitely talk to your vet about the plan and especially when the plan is to reevaluate that insulin level. So we definitely want that insulin level to come down. 200 is out of my comfort zone for sure. But there may be we have to give it some time, and especially if we've adjusted the diet, you know, that could take weeks to get that some time. So I think it's a consideration for sure, but I would definitely continue to work with your veterinarian and make sure that you're building in regular rechecks, reevaluations to assess that insulin level and monitor the decrease of that insulin level.
Dr. Schmidt, Deborah in Vermont wants to know generally how pergolide works to benefit horses with PPID.
Sure. So going back to the first question, just a little review of what PPID is. It's essentially a progressive age-related degenerative disease, which affects neurons in the brain that release dopamine. So essentially PPID horses aren't releasing enough dopamine, and therefore they lose the inhibitory braking action, so to speak, of dopamine on the pars intermedia or on the pituitary gland, a part of the pituitary gland. So they end up with this excessive overproduction of hormones, essentially. So pergolide is a dopamine agonist, or basically a dopamine receptor stimulant. So it can hopefully replace that missing inhibitory dopamine signal from the hypothalamus or from the brain, and reduce excessive hormone production. And it has been shown to reduce the clinical signs of PPID, as well as improve the results of endocrine testing, or basically reduce the ACTH levels that we test for to make that diagnosis of PPID. So essentially, it's just kind of replacing that dopamine action that those horses have lost with the degeneration.
Dr. Lowndes, Peyton from our live audience would like to know, if a horse is known to have a history of metabolic issues, so that impact a decision to breed that horse?
Yeah, so I think it definitely needs to be a consideration when you're choosing to breed that horse. I personally don't think it needs to rule the horse out completely, but I do think you need to keep in mind that mares naturally see a decrease in insulin sensitivity peripherally during the third trimester as they're kind of shunting glucose to the growing fetus, and can get some hyperinsulinemia even in non-metabolic, typically non-metabolic animals in that third trimester. And obviously, if you have a mare that is already prone to metabolic disease, she's more likely to have issues in that third trimester and could be at risk of gestational laminitis. As discussed before in the question about feeding your metabolic broodmare, it really does come down to managing the feeding in that time period. A lot of these broodmare grains tend to be quite high NSC, so finding one that is lower NSC, if she even needs a grain supplement in that third trimester, depending on the time of year she's falling out, a good quality hay forage diet with a ration balancer may be enough. And I would monitor her regularly throughout the pregnancy, monitor her insulin status, and just keep an eye and make sure she looks comfortable, isn't getting foot sore or any signs of laminitis. It's also worth mentioning that mares with metabolic syndrome can be a little bit harder to get in foal because they can frequently have reproductive issues as well.
Dr. Schmidt, Joy in Oregon asked how long she should soak her metabolic horse's hay to remove enough sugar and make it safer for him to consume.
Yeah, that's a great question. Very practical question, and I find there's quite a lot of information out there. So essentially, soaking hay in water can reduce water-soluble carbohydrates and help, you know, lower that overall carbohydrate concentration. I think currently the best recommendation, it comes from the equine endocrinology group, and they say to soak it for at least 60 minutes in cold water, especially if the hay is above a 10% NSC concentration. Now, there have been studies that have shown that warmer water can have a similar effect in a shorter amount of time. So for example, 22 degrees Celsius or 72 degrees Fahrenheit-ish, soaking hay for 30 minutes can decrease the water-soluble carbohydrate concentration by like 23 to 30-ish percent. So it's pretty good in a 30-minute time period, but the water does have to be warm, and you know, you need kind of a lot of water to soak hay. So it could be tricky to get that much water warmed up to 72 degrees Fahrenheit. The other thing with soaking hay, which was mentioned before too, is that It can make the hay kind of icky, for lack of a better word. And so in warm weather, especially, we want to sort of limit the soaking to maybe 1 to 2 hours, definitely not overnight. Also, excessive soaking will, you'll lose the minerals and trace elements. So to simplify my answer, I usually go with a cold water soak and I aim for like 1 to 2 hours. How about you, Dr. Lowndes? What's your general recommendation for that?
Yeah, we generally recommend soaking for an hour to 90 minutes. If you can do warm water, great. If you can't, cold water works.
Awesome. Dr. Lowndes, this will be our last question of the night, and it's from Candy in Ohio, who wants to know if horses who have foundered in the past can ever be comfortable barefoot. And do these horses benefit from corrective shoeing?
Hi, Candy. Good question. So the main things we try to address from a biomechanical point of view is going to be the strain put on the in these laminated horses is going to be the strain put on the lamellae from the action of the deep digital flexor tendon on the coffin bone, which is what's kind of responsible for causing these rotational changes we see on radiographs. And then we also want to ensure there's enough cushion protecting the coffin bone from the concussive forces of the hoof against ground, as when you get rotation and or sinking, we do lose some of that sole depth and the natural and that natural cushion of the sole. So yes, the best way to do that is going to be through corrective trimming and shoeing. We typically reduce the strain from the deep digital flexor tendon by easing breakover. This can be done by bringing back the toe, using a beveled shoe and or applying a wedge, while also implementing derotational trimming. Pads and impression material can be used to provide more cushion in cases with decreased sole depth. If you want to avoid putting on shoes, you could consider soft rider cloud boots, which have a wedge, bevel, and padding built into them and are specially designed for management of laminated horses. If derotational trimming is successful and sole depth can be improved, it may be possible for a horse to become comfortable barefoot again, but there's no guarantees. A lot also depends on the severity of the changes on radiographs, so this is definitely going to be something you need to work with your veterinarian and your farrier in tandem. And the other big part of the process is going to be making sure that insulin stays well regulated so that no further damage occurs to the lamellae while you're trying to address these biomechanical aspects.
That's all the time we have for tonight, but thank you both for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, thank you. And thank you to the audience for all the great questions.
Yes, definitely. Thank you for these great questions. And thank you to DECRA for sponsoring this event. Finally, thank you to everyone who listened tonight. If you're listening to us after the live event as a podcast episode, please rate, review, subscribe, and recommend Ask the Horse Live to a friend. Until next time, from everyone at The Horse, have a great night.